My name is Marina Draza. I am 36 years old. Today is September 27th, and I'm speaking with Nicholas Osa, who is my grandfather, and he's 86 years old, 50 years older than myself. We are in Loomis, California.
And the year is 2018.
The year is 2018. So, Grandpa, when did your parents get to California, or to the U.S.?
Oh, my gosh. I really don't know. Around 1900? I don't know the date or the year.
How did they get here?
My father sailed from, was on the ship, not sailed, but came across from Le Havre, France, on an ocean liner, docked in Ellis Island, and went from Ellis Island to Bingham, Utah, and worked in the open pit copper mine in Bingham, Utah. Arrived in the United States with $5 in his pocket, unable to speak English.
What language did he speak?
Spanish and the Basque language. And he, like many immigrants today, came to the United States for a better life. And this administration refuses to let people have a better life. This administration in September of 2018.
I don't think we should make this political. I think this is more about you. We can talk about politics another day. What about great-grandma?
Grandma came to the United States. I don't know. I don't remember the year. She went to Boise, Idaho, and worked as a maid in a hotel, a Basque hotel that catered to sheep herders who would get 4 or 5 days off a year, and it would come in. And my mother made beds. The hotel was owned by my aunt, her sister, Echeverria in Boise, Idaho. And my father came in from herding sheep, met my mother a year later, arrived back, came back again, married my mother. No correspondence in between because they were both illiterate at that time. My mother was always illiterate, never learned to write or read.
And she spoke what language?
She spoke Spanish and Basque.
Did she arrive in the 1900s, or was she already here?
She arrived in the 1900s.
And when were you born?
1932.
What's how many?
Susanville, California.
How many siblings?
How many stepbrothers?
Well, siblings. Well,
oh,
I don't know.
Siblings? How many? Nine.
You are.
And my sister Louise and I. I'm next to the youngest, and my sister Louise was third from the youngest, and we're the only two survivors.
And this is 2018. You were born in 1932.
Yes. Louise was born 1930. So at this point in time in my life, I'm older than most trees.
What was it like growing up in California in the 40s and 50s?
Great. We didn't have anything in regard to finances in the home. Father worked as a sheep herder in Bingham, Utah, and then as a sheep herder in Wendover, Nevada, in southern Idaho, southwestern Idaho, and southeastern Oregon and northern Nevada. That's where he herded sheep. Came to Susanville with my mother and my sister, Connie, Mary, and my brother, Joe, on the train that came to Reno and ended up in Susanville, went to work at a lumber mill. And my mother was a housewife.
What's your favorite story how do you picture them? Like, what do you, when you look back? Like, how do you remember them?
Well, I had a difficult relationship with my father growing up. I was always compared to my older brother, Mateo, or Spud, who was much more dedicated to work than I was at that point in time.
How old were you at that point in time?
Well, when I turned 13 or 14, you know, I was hauling hay, bucking bales, baling hay, hauling wheat, summer jobs on the farm. When I turned 16, I went to work. Summertime, I went to work in the lumber mill, at the planing mill, and then in the lumber yard, stacking lumber, or tearing down lumber. I did that when I was 16, in the summer of 17. And then I would have graduated in 81, but I was informed by my high school counselor that I was not graduating.
81 or 51?
In 1951.
Yeah.
So I quit high school, ran away from home, went to work for a telephone company in Rio Vista, California, converted the town from magneto crank phones to the dial system, then worked in Burnie, Redding, Bieber, California, Fall River Mills, erected microwave stations in Redding and Burnie, on Burnie Mountain. Went into the service in 1952, was in the Seabees, met my first wife.
That's mom's mom?
Yes.
How did you meet her?
I met her at the USO in Oxnard, California. I was stationed at Fort Wayne Henry. I subsequently asked her to marry me, not realizing she was engaged to someone else. I never found that out until later years in her marriage.
You know mom has an engagement ring. She gave it to Steffi.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, mom had the engagement ring. She gave it to Steffi,
yeah.
I think on her wedding day or something like
yeah.
that. Or like, yeah.
So we got married, and then two fellows I played basketball with on the base basketball team worked in the personnel office at the Port Hueneme, the CB base. And they thought it would be fun right after I got married if they put me on the posting list for duty in the Philippines. This was during the Korean War. And so I got married, and then 2 months later, I'm shipped out to the Philippines because Omar Anderson and Joe Simpson thought it was a big joke. So I ended up in the Philippines.
How long?
For 11 months. Came back, was stationed to Kodiak, Alaska, took my wife with me. And your mother was born in Kodiak, Alaska.
Yeah. This is 56, so it's a territory.
In August. Of 56, August 20, no, on May 4th, she was born on May 9th, 1956.
I'm not going to tell mom that you don't remember
no,
her birthday.
May 9th, 1956, at the Naval Hospital in Kodiak, Alaska.
Yeah.
And we came back to the States in August 1956. I received my discharge in Naval Station in Bremerton, Washington. Moved to Santa Rosa, California. Tried to get a job as heavy equipment operator because that's what I did in the CBs. But I had to be in the union, but the union wouldn't hire me until I found a job. But the union would not accept me as a Teamster operating engineer unless I had a job. But I couldn't get a job unless I belonged to the union.
Yeah, so it's a catch 22.
So it was a catch 22. So then about a year later, we moved to Ventura. Subsequently found a job at the juvenile hall in Ventura as a counselor. Going to school, I was in my senior year when your grandmother died. And by that time, I had Renee, Mary, Liz, and Monica. So, mother died in December 1964, your grandmother,
mm-hmm.
and I moved with my children to Paso Robles, August of 1965, went to work for the Youth Authority as a teacher on a temporary assignment, and was offered a teaching job in Susanville because I'd my, by this time I had my teaching credential, and I turned that down. And Vic Kirk was the superintendent at the Youth Authority Institution. He asked me to take the state parole agent's exam. He wanted me to work as a parole agent. I did. Fortunately for me, I came out number one in the state.
Of course.
And, you know, from there, went to South Central L.A.
Mom.
South Central L.A. and walked.
Mom, tell stories of you having parolees babysit the kids when you went out dating.
Oh, that was in, well, and then I was working at Watts, South Central L.A., and I was contacted by the Community Treatment Project of Sacramento, California, which was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It was pure treatment. We had staff psychiatrists, we had psychologists on duty, we had teachers, counselors, and parole agents, social workers. And so I went to work the CTP project in Sacramento for approximately 3 years. I was identified as a worker with gang leaders. So I worked with gang leaders, gang bangers.
How are they different from today?
And they were Hispanic and Black. They were different than, they were called CFCs, Cultural Conformist Mature, and they were different than their followers because they had that leadership quality. They were sure of themselves. And that was probably the best experience of my parole years.
Why?
Well, because I could do so many things with them. As a matter of fact, when I retired, one of them came to my retirement.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Then another one, I put through Volk Rehab, hairstylist. His sister was a hairstylist. Ernesto was his name. And when I moved back to the Sacramento area here 30 years ago, about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I started searching for Ernesto, and I found him working in a barber shop in Sacramento, South Sacramento, on Flowing Road. And I walked in, I asked for Ernesto. He was seated in a chair. He was eating his lunch, and there was a vacant barber's chair. And I asked for him, and he said, "That's me." And he raised his hand as he's eating, and he said, "Just sit in the chair, I'll be right with you." And I moved over and sat next to him, and I said, "Ernesto, you don't know me, do you?" And there were five chairs, four of them occupied, and four other people waiting for a haircut. Obviously, they had famous, favorite barbers. So anyway, I moved over next to Ernesto. I said to him, "Ernesto, you don't know me, do you?" And he looked at me, and he shouted, "Holy shit, my motherfucking parole agent."
How many years passed was this?
Huh?
How many years had he not been his parole agent?
Oh, my God. No. It's probably, I would imagine, I never thought of it. It was probably 20 some years since I'd seen him. Then I tried to find another parolee who ended up as a supervisor with the Parks and Recreation Department in Sacramento. Never able to find him. Then I was walking across the prison grounds at when I became deputy secretary. I appointed deputy secretary by the governor, Governor Duke Majan, deputy secretary of a correctional agency. And I was familiarizing myself with the wardens of state prisons across California. So I was on a travel schedule. And I was walking across the grounds at, I think it was DBI in Tracy, if I recall correctly. And there was a worker coming towards me with two inmates at the prison. And as we started to pass each other going in opposite directions, I said hello, and he said hello. And then he started to talk, and he says, the same thing I said to Ernie. He says, "You don't know me, do you?" And I said, "No." I said, "Don't tell me your name, you'll just talk to me." And he talked, and it clicked, and I said, "David." And he had two inmates with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Hi, Dad." And he gave me a hug with the warden there and the inmates watching. One of the highlights of my career.
How long had it been since you'd seen him?
About the same period of time, 20, 25 years.
How many people did you were a parole agent for?
In a community treatment project, I had 10 kids on parole to me.
How,
10 young adults up to age 24.
What age did they start at?
Hmm?
What age did they start?
They started probably 17, 16, 17.
Did most of them turn around? Did they go back? Or
that's one of the difficulties being a parole agent. You think you're successful. I had a parolee at a halfway house down in Vista, California, who I got a job with a nursery in San Marcos, California. He worked there for 2 years. He was in the halfway house for 2 years, saved his money, bought his car, did extremely well on parole. They loved him at the nursery. I discharged him from parole, and he moved back up to his home area up out of Pasadena, a Burbank area. And years later, I don't recall, let's see, I retired 30 years ago. So it had to have been probably 10 years passed by, and maybe 10, 12 years later, after I discharged him from parole, I was walking across the grounds with a warden at Folsom State Prison, and this inmate said to me, "Hi, Mr. Osa," and it was this parolee that I discharged from parole, who went to work for a Japanese couple in a nursery up in Burbank or Pasadena. He got hooked on drugs again, and he murdered the both of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I looked up his record at Folsom when I was there. And then he was suspected of being a hitman on another murder at San Quentin. So, you asked me how many were successful?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone could say. Human behavior, you don't know what triggers them. So, I don't know.
What's the hardest part about being a parole agent?
I think finding parents who have given up totally on their kids. Trying to convince, you know. Well, and kids who have given up, people who have given up on themselves. I used to say to my parolee the first time that I'd meet them when they'd come out of the prison system, out on the streets, "You could think what you want about me as your parole agent. You can think I'm a son of a bitch. You can even call me a son of a bitch if that makes you comfortable. But know this, I'm not going to let you destroy yourself."
Do you think that was effective?
I think some of them heard that message, yeah.
Well, it's obvious some people actually respected the message enough to try. You know, if it came to you at your retirement party.
Yeah. There were some successes, I know that. So probably a lot of failures, too, I'm sure of that as well. It was a great job. I love being a parole agent. It's the best job I have. Far superior to being I was appointed to the state parole board by the governor, and then appointed deputy secretary. Those jobs were pale in comparison to working with people on the streets.
Tell me a good story of working with somebody on the streets. A story you're really proud of.
Well, I was proud of Welton. He was a 17-year-old, orphaned, young black, extremely handsome, very, very athletic, about 6'2", about 190 pounds. When I was assigned to the CTP project in Sacramento, which was this research project, my first day on the job, you were given a book with the parolees' names in it, in alphabetical, and there were pages behind the name. Every contact, you would write something, what was said, kind of thing. And the parolees' printout sheet also had a calendar on it, so you would check the calendar date when you met. And my first day in the office, my phone rang, and this guy says, "You're my new parole agent?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Who is this?" And he says, "This is Welton blank blank. I won't give you his name." And I looked in my book, and I said, yes, I am. And he said, I just want you to know, I'm down here in San Francisco with my honey, and I don't know when I'll be in. Now, these were gang leaders, okay? And my immediate response to him was, "That's too bad, because if you don't have your fucking ass in my office in 5 minutes, I'm putting a warrant out for your arrest," and I hung up the phone. And about 2 minutes later, the guy stands in my doorway and is Welton. This is in Sacramento.
So he was
testing. So anyway, he says, "I'm Welton." Someone's blank, blank. And I got up and we shook hands. We were about the same height. You know, I was 6'2", 6'3". He was 6'2". And we're shaking hands. We're both standing on tiptoes, squeezing as hard as we can. So anyway, I got him a job with Sears in a warehouse on Florin Road. They really, really liked him there. He was an extremely handsome kid. And I was 17, 18. And this time he was 18. Then I swung by Sears one day and he wasn't there. He wasn't on the job. So I went by his foster home where he was living. They hadn't seen him in 2 days. So I went by Sears again the next day. The foster home, he still wasn't there. Finally, he called me about 4 days later. He'd got paid on the job, took his money, took his girlfriend, and did go to San Francisco, and blew it all. So anyway, he comes back. I put him on my van. I worked with in a van because I worked with gang kids, and I put all the guys in it together at one time, take them places.
This is no seatbelts, no nothing, just in the back of the van.
Oh, yeah, no seatbelts. So anyway,
this is the 60s.
I put Welton in the van and drove to Stockton. I went to Stockton County Jail off of I-5. And locked him up for 29 days. I picked him. And in the meantime, I got him a job that summer with the State Division of the State Division of Forestry, California, fighting fires up in Burning, California for the summer season.
Hard job.
Oh, so I picked him up on the morning of the 30th day because I could lock him up for 30 days without a warrant at that time. And we jump in the van and Oh, and I had him put in isolation when I locked him up. I told the jailer that he was extreme risk. They were dumbfounded when I picked him up that I didn't put handcuffs on him. So, anyway, we're driving back, and all he could talk about was getting together with his honey in Sacramento. And he was absolutely elated. When he felt good, he called me Nick. When he was worried, he'd call me Mr. Osa. So it's Nick, I'm getting together with my honey. Nick, this. And we got to Sacramento, and I blow through Sacramento on the freeway. And he goes quiet. And we're clear up by Woodland, north of Davis, by this time. And we're driving up to Bernie. That's way, way up in Northern California. Way, you know, it's not too far from Oregon. And he says to me, finally, he said, quit talking. He said, Mr. Osa. He said, where are we going? And I said, well, Welton, I says, I have a job. I got a job for you for the summer. We're going up to Bernie, California, and you're going to be working for the Forestry Division. You're going to be fighting fires. And that shows you how much has changed. They hired him with no training, nothing. It's so different than today.
Yeah.
So anyway, he said, where's Bernie? I said, it's up in the mountains. He says, one of my favorite lines. Mr. Osa, he says, I can't go to the mountains. I can't go to the mountains. And I said, well, why not? Well, he said, because Mr. Osa, he says, I'm afraid of high places. So that's my favorite line. Anyway, he lasted the summer. He was the last one that they let go. He absolutely loved it. In the meantime, I got him a job with Sacramento City Parks and Recreation Department. When the fire season ended, he came back. I got him a job with Parks and Rec. He had a job waiting for him. Went to work for Parks and Rec. And then about a year later, I discharged him from parole because I transferred to San Diego parole. And then I heard from other parole agents that I'd worked with in that project. Over the years, I'd hear from other parole agents, or I'd bump into them somewhere in the state. And they'd always talk about Welton, how well he did with Parks and Rec, and ended up as a supervisor with the Parks and Recreation Department.
This is the one you tried to look up?
Yes, and I unable to find. But the interesting thing about Welton, when I finally got his attention, he came into the office one day, and we had classrooms and everything. We had a big room in the back of our facility, and there were two hallways. And between the hallways was a conference room. Behind the conference room was this big rec room with classrooms on either side. But you walked in the front door, and if you walked straight, you went down one hallway, and there were parole offices on the left. If you turned to the right and went down the hallway, there were parole offices on the right. So I'm up in the front office one day, and Welton comes in. He says, you know, I want to talk to you. And I said, fine. So my office was on the left hallway. So we start to walk, and I'm over standing in the right hallway. And he said, well, we start through the conference room, just a shortcut. And we had a big, long table with the state-issued chairs, you know, with aluminum legs and plastic molding. And I turn around, and Welton says to me, he closed the door behind him, and the other door was closed. And he said, Mr. Olson, he said, we can talk here. And I turn around, and at that time, they wore the three-quarter length leather jackets.
Yeah.
They had the big afros.
Did he have a big afro?
And I turn around, and here he is, all duped out, ready to fight. He's in, his fists are up, and I thought, you know what?
I was brand new on the project. I'd been there about 2 weeks at this time. And I thought, holy shit, what do I do? So he just sort of threw a left jab all at me, and I just grabbed some jacket on the sleeve and pulled him towards me, and I threw my knee into his groin area and knocked him back up against the wall. And that entire wall in that conference room just boom. And he sort of doubled over, and I pulled him toward me, and he tripped over his chair, and he sprawled out on the conference table, and I was on his back, and I had this mass of soft,
curl,
kinky, black hair, and I was pounding his face down into the table. When the door opened, and all these parole agents rushed in, my project director walked in, my the psychiatrist, the doctor walked in, rushed in. The project director, Glenn Avery, won in. Jim McHale, my supervisor, came in. And all these parole agents just flooded in. And Glenn Avery, who was the project director, you know, I'm on pump. He said, what in the hell's going on here? And I stopped and I said, we're having a counseling session. And he said, good. He said, everyone out of the room. And they've left me there. They closed the door. But I got Welton's attention. Years later, after I discharged him for parole. Okay? And after I discharged him for parole, and then, you know, a few days later, I was leaving. And he came into the office, and I got him an honorable discharge. He said, Nick, he said, do you remember the counseling session we had in the conference room? I said, yes, yeah, I do. I said, I'll never forget that. He said, I won't either. He said, you know what? He said, it's a good thing it ended when it did, because he said, I was getting ready to get all over you like I get on my honey.
Which one of these guys did you have babysit mom and her sisters?
Hmm?
Which one of these guys did you have babysit mom and her sisters when you were starting to date
Welton.
Again? Welton was the one dated.
Welton was one. Dave, who saw me at the prison, who called me dad,
yeah,
gave me a hug. His father was extremely brutal to him. And I, as a matter of fact, I had Dave sleep at my house. And his father threw him out. He had no place to stay. And unbeknownst to me, the director, the assistant director of the Youth Authority, lived on the other side of the fence, my back fence, in Land Park area of Sacramento. I didn't know that until I had Welton over for a couple of days and David over for a couple of days. And I was called into headquarters office in Sacramento. And I didn't even know who these people were. I had, you know, I knew the name.
Yeah.
But I'd never met them. I'd never seen them. And I was called into headquarters office in Sacramento. The director of parole services was there, and the regional administrator of parole. And they told me, you had two parolees over your house? I said, yes. You know, that's violation of the rules and regulations. I said, no, I didn't know that. Well, it is. You either stop it now or you're out of a job.
What was the reason behind it?
Well, it's, you know, these kids are violent kids.
Yeah, but you trusted them with your kids.
Yeah, but you know, you think you know a person and you don't. Especially parolees. They're great manipulators. You know, if they lived a straight life, they'd be great businessmen.
They've got the charm, the look.
They've got everything. Yeah. Everything but family. Because the gang was their family. That's where they received their accolades. Their strength, their compliments, belonging, ego boosters. That's where it all occurred. Not at home. So, and then I subsequently ended my career. For Relation 3, I was a consultant with the Youth Authority inspecting county jails and juvenile halls, probation camps. My primary assignment was Orange, Los Angeles, San Diego, Riverside, Imperial, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Yomono counties. But every once in a while I'd come up to do Sutter, Butte, Lassen, Lake County, San Francisco, inspecting. And then I was just appointed State Parole Board by Duke Majan, and then subsequently appointed Deputy Director. Started out at Ventura Juvenile Hall as a group supervisor, entry level, and ended up, step and a half removed from a cabinet position.
Do you think being a parole agent was the highlight of everything? You're 86 now. What would you say is the highlight of
my professional career?
Well, everything. If we put a proudest moment professional career, I would say your parole stuff. But what about personal?
The highlight of my life are my children.
And how many kids do you have?
I have 4. Actually, I have 5. I have a daughter with a cerebral palsy and mentally retarded. I have not seen her in years and years and years. The last time I saw her, she didn't know who I was. I took her off the grounds that she was at Porterville State Hospital. Put her in my car, wanted to buy her. Gonna go out and have lunch, take her, whatever. And the moment we left the ground, she just started screaming and screaming and crying and screaming. And she never stopped. So I drove back to the grounds. And as soon as I parked the car, and as soon as we walk in to the grounds, it all stopped. So I talked to the social worker about what happened. And I told her how heart-wrenching it was. And she said, "Your daughter doesn't know you." And she said, I think, Mr. Osa, you may feel a lot of guilt for not visiting, but I think for your own sanity that you should not be visiting your daughter."
Yeah.
And so I never went back. And I've always felt guilty about that. So.
And then you have, so you...
And then, I feel guilty that your grandmother...
Helen?
...died. And I don't know why I feel guilty about that, but I do. And then your step-grandmother...
Anna May. Matt's mom.
Died of cancer. And that one I feel guilty about. The morning she died, we had hospice care at home. She was in bed. I got up in the morning, made coffee, went back into the bedroom, was talking to the hospice worker. I asked her how Anna May was during the night. She said, "Fine." She slept all night long. And I said, "Fine." I said, "I'm going to go get a cup of coffee." So I left the bedroom and walked into the kitchen and got a cup of coffee. And for some unknown reason, I went out to the garage, opened the garage door, backed my car out, and started sweeping the floor in the garage. And now this is, we're talking 5 minutes elapsing. And the social worker came out and said, "Mr. Osa, your wife just died." I still feel a lot of guilt about that, because I wasn't in the room when she passed on.
So if you could leave grandkids and great-grandkids, because you're a great Nick, what kind of advice would you give to us? If you could leave us with any sort of wisdom,
Be true to yourself. Help those who need help. I think the great gift in life, I think the, probably one of the greatest gifts in life is helping someone in need without them being aware that you've helped them. So, yeah, my advice is be true to yourself. Take care of your family. Because the older you get, the more precious they become.
You just had all your family, or a lot of family, fly up for your birthday.
Yes, and I'm so fortunate that way. Yeah.
Where did we come from?
Well, I think it comes from your mother. You know, your grandmother was a lovely lady. Helen was. And in their own way, they're all very, very generous. You know, like Grandma Judy now struggling with cancer. She's just a giving person. Her outlook, you know, is fantastic. And, so, yeah, be true to yourself. Help those who need help. Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say in the last minutes? Something you want to be remembered by?
What's that?
Is there anything you want to be remembered by?
If anything, I think I'd like to be remembered as a compassionate person who likes to help others, especially others in need. I hope my grandchildren and children remember me as a loving father and grandfather.
I mean, you're the tall man with the tall tails.
The what?
The tall man. That's what DJ calls you, the tall man with the tall tails.
Yeah. The cigars.
Cigars sitting
the cones, the scotch.
Sitting on the porch, you smoking a cigar, drinking a whiskey, shooting the squirrels with a BB gun because they're eating your apples.
Anyway, that's...
Now here's the tough question. This is a leading question. So am I your favorite? And with that, we'll end.
You are. Yeah, you are one of the leading candidates. I